Today is March 24th, 2021, and I'm here with Katina Lowry, who I'll be interviewing as a part of the Southwest Virginia LGBTQ Oral History Project. Thank you so much for being here with us today and contributing to our project. Typically, these interviews tend to be in person.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, no problem. These interviews tend to be in person, but understandably this year, due to COVID-19, there's been some reasonable precautions. We're going to be remote this year. It would have been nice to meet you in person, and hopefully we can in the future. But I want to go ahead and get started with asking you about your upbringing in Virginia. Were you born and raised here?
I was born and raised in Chris'sburg.
All right, sounds good. Where'd you go to school?
Did you hear that?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, okay, you heard. I'm sorry. Where did I go to school?
Yeah.
All right. Let's see. I graduated through the Chris'sburg system, so primary school, middle school, high school. Then college level, my freshman year, I went to DePaul University out in Chicago, Illinois. Then I transferred to Virginia Tech. I was at Tech for about for a few years, and we can go into why I left Tech. Not gay related, more color related. Then I moved out to Chicago from there, and I finished up my degree at North Park University in Chicago. Two degrees. Oh. I have a master's degree too.
Oh wow! Lots of moving around between Chicago and Virginia. It seems like.
Yeah, I love Chicago's a good town.
That's awesome. So kind of going back to like more of your childhood and like, how was it like growing up when you were young, you know, was your childhood upbringing, was it normal, you know, or, you know, did you face any difficulty growing up? Were you bullied or anything like that? Or
like in terms of being LGBT?
Just in general.
I mean, I'm not going to say LGBT, I'm a lesbian, sir. You mean in terms of being like a lesbian or just in general? Because everybody has problems.
You know what I mean? Yeah, sure. Absolutely. Yeah. And we could, yeah, definitely. If we can look at that question a few ways, you know, how was your upbringing growing up? Was it difficult because maybe, did you face any like racial discrimination or was that like more paramount over being, you know, a lesbian? So anything like that you faced while growing up in your earlier years?
Right. Well, okay. Well, I will say, you know, growing up in Chris'sburg, I didn't know that I was a lesbian. And I know I'd mentioned this to you guys before on our initial talk together. So I grew up, I mean, I would say I'm a child of like the 80s and the 90s because I was born in 72. So in the 80s and 90s and even the 70s when I was growing up in Chris'sburg, there were no out LGBT people. Now, I'm not saying they didn't exist. It just wasn't, as you see today, out. You know, these days people are out. So I really had no concept, to be honest with you, of sexual orientation when I was growing up. Didn't really think about it. You get what I'm saying. When I look back on it, when I think about like my friendships that I've had, with like women and, you know, my interaction with my male friends, looking back on it, I can identify it as, oh, ding, ding, I was a lesbian. You know what I'm saying? So
no,
my female friends, we'd have like sleepovers, we'd snuggle and everything, but I didn't associate that with anything but friendship because I had no other model or influences to associate that with anything other than, oh, well, we're just women and this is what we do, we're friends. And then when I look at my relationship with my males, and to be honest with you, even to this day, it's kind of weird. All my close friends have always been like male friendships. And so, but when, like I said, looking back on it, I think that's just associated with my sexual orientation. So I really didn't identify anyway as straight, gay, or anything growing up, just because, like I said, I had no context for it. I had no role models. It wasn't talked about in my growing up. I was never called a lesbian or a dyke or anything of that nature. Now, in terms of the color of my skin, which is the obvious part, Yeah, I mean, I was called a nigger. You know, the first time I can remember the word nigger, and keep in mind, 70s, 80s, right? Growing up in Christiansburg, which is especially back then, less now, it's more diverse. But when I was growing up, it was a predominantly white community. I mean, my graduating class was probably a little over 100 people, and I'd say there's probably five or so of us that were people of color. And when I say people of color, we're not talking about Latinos and Asian, and we're talking about you black or you're white or you're mixed, you know? And so I do remember when I was a little kid, we were driving from, it was me and my sister and my mother in the car, and we were just driving along in Christiansburg on College Street where I grew up, past the little hop-in, and I don't even remember where we were going. And it was, you know, it was a sunny day, and my mom had the windows down, and I just, these white men drove by us and screamed out, nigger. And that was the first time I ever even experienced the word nigger. And I mean, I didn't quite get that concept, but I can tell you that in like third grade, I believe it was, before you like change classes, when you hit like junior high and then you meet different teachers, you have the same teacher in third grade, at least that's how it was when I grew up. I remember, but you have to think about the history of Virginia. It was one of the states, once they integrated the school system, that practiced active resistance to integrating the school systems. So the fact that I was born in 72, so by the time I hit third, fourth, fifth grade, where you don't, you know, change classes or whatever, and the fact that Virginia was one of the holdover states, basically, when I went through school in my younger years, what that meant was the textbooks hadn't changed yet because it hadn't caught up yet. And forgive me, it wasn't third grade, it was fifth grade. I remember this specifically, so let me correct that. It was actually fifth grade. My teacher was Miss Brown. And because the textbooks hadn't caught up yet, and we were using the holdover textbooks when it was all white and everything was segregated, there was a chapter that we all had to read. I'm the only black person in class, and it was describing what a Negro is. And the textbook, and this wasn't even coming from the teacher, it was literally the textbook that we were required to read and study. And it said, this is what a Negro looks like. They have thick, full lips. They have flat, broad noses. And I remember, you know, all the kids in class kind of turned around and looking at me. And I think that that was the first time that we all realized that, oh, there's something different. I mean, we're kids. We don't really care about that stuff until someone points it out, you know? And I would say after that, in terms of just growing up, the next time I actually heard the word, quote, nigger, actually came from someone who was mulatto. At least that's what we called it back in the day, meaning one parent was white, one parent was black. And this was actually in middle school when you get to change classes. And it was in gym class and it was co-ed, you know, and we were playing dodgeball. And there was a kid there who, like I said, was of mixed race. He was, you know, one parent was black, one parent was white. And I got him out in dodgeball and he said, you fucking nigger. I'm sorry if I'm not supposed to cuss in this.
No, please, no, please do if you feel comfortable.
It's a quote, and that's what happened.
Yeah, absolutely. And no, so, please do.
And it just devastated me because I was kind of like, well, it was just weird. And at the time, my mom, because my mother for 40 some years worked in the Montgomery County school system, specifically in Christiansburg. And so she actually worked at the middle school that I was going to school at the time I was in middle school. And my routine was I didn't even use a locker like all the other kids. I used my mom's classroom as my locker. So after gym class, you know, I was, you know, going to my mom's, you know, classroom and I'm like dropping off my books to pick up the other books from, you know, my next class. And she's like, what's wrong with you? Why are you looking all down? Whatever. And I told her what happened. Well, this guy called me a nigger, you know. So my mom like rips out of the classroom, and she's like, "Hoo, hoo!" And I point the guy out because again, we were in the process of changing classes. I pointed him out. She rips him up by his, you know, collar and takes him to the principal's office. So, yeah, I mean, that for me, that was, you know, my concept of discrimination. Yeah, the fact that I had no concept of sexual orientation from grade K through 12 probably prevented me from, you know, the LGBT type of discrimination, to be honest with you. Now, was I perceived to be gay? I don't know. I mean, I think it's clear. I certainly as I grew older and people just assume that I'm gay, but I guess, you know, like I said, the innocence of those times, I don't think people really pictured all that, but I will tell you, when I moved back from Chicago, which was in 2009, and I connected, you know, with a few high school friends and blah, blah, blah. Apparently there was this whole gay scene going on that I didn't even know about. So I'm like, oh, really? Well, I don't know. So apparently somebody was aware, it just wasn't me.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So you would say, like, most of your experiences in terms of discrimination are more defined by your race rather than your sexuality.
Well, that's a really hard question. And let me tell you why. If you're being discriminated against, someone doesn't like you, they're mad at you, is it because you're a woman? Is it because you're black? Or is it because you're gay? I don't know. Mm. Unless they say nigger, dyke, bitch. You get what I'm saying? Yeah, discrimination. Even you look at folks who feel like they've been discriminated in the workplace. And they're like, I'm going to file a lawsuit. You discriminate me because I'm black. Right? Lawyers have a hard time when have multiple, right? You're part of multiple minority groups distinguishing what was the discrimination. Was it because you're a woman? Was it because you're black? Or is it because you're a lesbian? And is it a combination of all three? I mean, it's a hard thing, honestly, to distinguish. Like, how do I know? You don't like me because what? I don't know. I mean, the first thing that you see when you see me is that I'm black and that I'm a woman. Maybe after you get to know me and you see my mannerisms, then you know that I'm gay. So what's the discrimination? Is it a combination of all three? Who knows?
Yeah, that's interesting. And like, even knowing that you're a part of a group that has faced discrimination, like historically, like you can just assume that somebody, you don't have to know the reason, you just know. Right. So I can understand, like, does that resonate with you a bit?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I can't distinguish. I mean, certainly there have been people in my life that don't like me for whatever reason. But, I mean, I don't know why that is. Unless I heard, like I told you, dyke, nigger, bitch. Then you're telling me why you hate me. Other than that, I don't know. I have to, you know, I don't have just one aspect of being a minority, so I can't distinguish between the three what you don't like about me.
No, that's absolutely right. I can understand that.
Yeah.
How was your home life, like with your parents? Did you have a feeling that they knew that you were different in some way, or like?
Well, probably so, because I was a tomboy growing up. I mean, girls played with dolls and this and that. I played with bikes and guns and little army men. And it was totally encouraged. I mean, I had a great upbringing in terms of that, in terms of my identity and coming into an adult. I was never judged. I was never criticized for being who I was. It was always encouraged. If I wanted a gun for Christmas or a little army boy or something that was weird and, you know, my mom and stepfather didn't care. They said, oh, get it for her. I mean, so I never felt that being a tomboy was wrong. It was incorrect. I mean, it was just, well, that's who she is. If she wants that, get it for her. I mean, so, yeah, I mean, I feel that my identity was always validated within my family. But keep in mind, I'm not generalizing because not all black people have that experience in their household, and it really depends on people, you know. But keep in mind, my mother was one of the very first black people to integrate racially into Withville High School. Okay. My stepfather, being a black man, was in and out of the system, you know, was discriminated against his entire life for being a black man. And he also, back in those days, and this is something that you guys maybe can research just on a side note, outside of your project, which is LGBT specific, but there's something very interesting about the community of Christiansburg, Virginia, that should be taught in history books across the nation, but it isn't. And that's the fact that there was a place called Christiansburg Industrial Institute. Okay. And I'll just very quickly, it was a school started by a Quaker called William Schaefer, who was a reverend of Quaker religion. And after the Civil War, when the South fell, he came to Christiansburg, Virginia, and he basically educated the black community. So you have, you know, black folks running around like, what am I going to do? You know, we don't have plantations anymore. They didn't know what to do. He said, well, I'm going to come. I'm a Quaker. Because, you know, they're all about, you know, the liberation of black folk. And he came to Christiansburg, Virginia, and he started a school. He didn't just start it for black people. He wanted everybody to attend, but white people didn't want to go to school with black people. So at the, so basically what happened was the black community was more educated than the white community in Christiansburg, Virginia. And Christiansburg Institute was a massive institution that owned, where black folks owned their own hospital, their own education system, horse farms. I mean, it was a self-sustaining community in Christiansburg. And if you look at history, because I know I did my dissertation on it when I was in college, and I studied this whole history of Christiansburg, which is amazes me. And basically what happened was finally when Virginia decided that they were going to integrate in the 70s, keep that in mind, white folks could not wait to get rid of Christiansburg Institute. And you look at news reports and they're like, you know, I wish that my son or daughter was educated like them black folk, because you had, you know, these kids going from this school to Ivy League schools, which was unheard of in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, right? Well, that wasn't happening at the white high school, so they couldn't wait to tear that school down because it made them look bad. And in fact, if you look at the history of the NAACP, when they were bringing their case to integrate the school system, they first stopped in Christiansburg, Virginia, at Christiansburg Industrial Institute. And they said, well, we're going to prove that separate but equal doesn't work. It just doesn't work. And so they went to Christiansburg Industrial Institute, and then they buried it because they realized that it does work. And I'm not trying to make any kind of, you know, inference of anything, but what happened was when they went to Christiansburg, and they saw these black folks going to Ivy League schools, owning their own businesses, their own hospitals, their own land. They got scared, and they felt that that was going to hurt their case to integrate the school, so they buried it. And that, and that, and that's just the truth of the history. So I come from that tradition. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying all black people in Christiansburg come from that, but I can tell you that the Christiansburg Industrial Institute, I mean, these people are dying off, but they still exist, and they're trying to start up that museum in Christiansburg. But yeah, I mean, that's just my background. I mean, I don't know. I don't mean to ramble.
No, that's okay. No, it's interesting because there's this neighborhood in Roanoke called, I believe it's Gainsboro, and that was where there was some prominent LGBTQ community forming there. But it was mostly and predominantly black. But over time,
I'm gonna dim my shades. I think the light is kind of the sunlight.
Oh, sure. You know, take your time.
I think the sunlight is causing a little shadow there. Tell me if I need to.
No, dim. No, it's okay.
But I will just say this generally. Let's just be clear that there is racism within the LGBT community. And, So when I lived in Chicago, first time away from home, blah, 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 and outside of the college life, I worked in, you know, three very prominent nonprofit agencies for the LGBT community. I worked for the Gay and Lesbian Chamber of Commerce. I worked for Affinity Community Services, and I worked for Lambda Legal, which, as you know, is a national organization and the oldest LGBT legal organization in the country for LGBT community. And I just want to be very clear that racism is huge in the LGBT community. And I experienced it firsthand as a professional working on the civil rights of LGBTQA folks. So I just want to point that out too. I just wanted to say that generally.
Oh, no, interesting. Do you want to elaborate on that? Is there like a certain like a situation or circumstance you found yourself in?
To be perfectly honest with you, we can go on for days. We can go on
I don't know. I mean, if you're comfortable with, I mean,
I'm sorry, this sun is killing me. Sorry.
No, it's okay. It's okay.
It is bright in here for the evening. It's usually not that bright. But all right, so I can go on for days and, but let's see. How about we start with, all right.
Did you want to talk about something else and maybe we can lead into
No. I just want to give you a good example is all. I'm trying to think of a good.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Lambda Legal. All right. The nations, and you might as well say the world, because it's not like some other country has like some LGBT, you know, legal organization. So, as you know, Lambda Legal came out of Stonewall, right? Now, we all know Stonewall was a white movement. It's about white folk going to white bars and getting their asses kicked. Now, I'm not saying there weren't black people in the mix, but come on, let's just be honest. I'm not saying there weren't trans people in the mix, but let's just be honest. This was about gay white men mad because they got X'd out of their privilege. And if it wasn't for them being gay, they'd be part of that other privilege and they mad about it. I mean, I'm sorry, let's just be honest. So I worked for Lambda Legal for like 4 years. And to be honest, it would have been beyond that if I didn't have to move back here because my mom got sick. But we always had major issues at Lambda with race. So all the attorneys, you know, they are, most of them are Ivy League educated. Harvard, Yale, and they're all white, except for maybe one or two with little tokens over there. But all of the outreach, like they don't have an outreach staff now. They nixed that. But when I worked for Lambda Legal, we had a whole outreach department, like every office, right? Because it's a national office. So we had offices in LA, Chicago. I worked in the Chicago office, Atlanta, blah, 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 New York. And so all the outreach staff, meaning the face of the agency that went out to the community to talk to folks, well, we were all people of color. We were either black or Latino. Okay, the top of the agency and the attorneys, they were all white people. Let's just be clear. Now, you look at things like the institution of marriage. Okay, I helped with that whole thing. I helped pass marriage legislation in the state of Iowa. And the whole thing is, when you even look at the institution of marriage, especially back in the day when it was first, you know, coming up, we were starting to get, you know, legislatures passing it or fighting in the court and blah 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 blah. The whole thing was this whole institution of marriage as the predominant push for the LGBT community was a white thing. Okay. Now, when you look at folks of color, Latinos, black folks, Asians, whatever you have it, marriage wasn't their top priority. You know why? Because they were getting their ass beat for being gay or lesbian or trans. They weren't thinking about getting married. That's an issue of privilege. They were thinking about, am I going to live tomorrow? Right? Am I going to go to school and get my ass beat? Am I going to go to work and get fired for being gay? You get me? So the whole marriage thing that Land Illegal, you know, and ACLU and all these other agencies were pushing, I mean, it was really just a concept of white privilege. It's just like, okay, well, we're white, but the only, and if it wasn't for the fact that we couldn't be married, you know, that's the one thing that's preventing us from our white privilege. Okay, well, that's great. And I'm not saying that gay marriage is a bad thing. I think that's an important thing. But in the whole concept of what is important, what is the priority, what do the diversity of the LGBTQA blah, blah, blah community faces, that was not the major push for folks of color. That was the major push for gay white men. And that was because it was the one thing that prevented them from their white privilege. Well, we ain't folks of privilege. All right, we get fired every day. We're walking in black communities and Latin and getting our asses beat for being gay or perceived to be. So our priority was safety, equality, equal rights, not issues of privilege.
That's fascinating to me.
I would tell you, so every year at Land Illegal, we would do what's called an employee retreat to work on basically the overall strategic plan of the agency, right? And I remember there was this one year, and I can't even remember where it was. I think it was somewhere in Connecticut or something. So we all got together, like we did annually, to talk about, oh, what should the strategic plan be, you know, for the upcoming year? What goals have we met for this past year, blah, blah, blah. And it got so heated between the staff, meaning, you know, us outreach staff, which was the color of the agency, and the white folk, which was the attorneys and everybody above them. We're sitting there one day at this retreat, and it was usually like a week long or something like that. And we're sitting there, and Sheba, who was my outreach coworker that worked out of the Texas office, Dallas, walks in with a sign on her shirt that said Negro. That's how bad it got. That's how bad it got. Mm-hmm.
Well,
yeah. So I'm just saying, you know, the other thing I'll mention is how the LGBT lead agencies always want these other groups to sign on to their stuff to move forward their civil rights, right? NAACP, oh, please sign on to our amicus brief about marriage or about this or about that. Oh, ACLU, please sign on to this, sign on to that. Oh, Asian Pacific Island, everybody. They always want other prominent groups to sign on to whatever they're doing to move their civil rights forward. Now, let's just keep that, what I just said, in mind. Now, when it comes, and that's fine. NAACP did it, and it was hard for them. They didn't want to sign on to no gay stuff because they homophobic, but they did. They did. Now, when you look at the flip side, okay, you got George Floyd, you got all these things going on in communities of color. Do you think these LGBT prominent groups are signing on to their amicus briefs? They will only do it if it specifically affects what they considered it is their rights as LGBT people, even though they've piggybacked on every other movement. The LGBT community, all the rights that we've achieved is a piggyback of the Black Civil Rights Movement and the Women's Movement, all right? Now, they'll sign on to anything that has to do with Roe versus Wade. Now, keep in mind that our right to privacy as gay people, meaning the cops ain't kicking down our door because we're having sex in the bedroom, comes from Lawrence v. Texas. That's the case that changed the law for the LGBT community. Now, what's that case based on? It's based on Roe v. Wade. Roe v. Wade. That's what that case is based on. So, and that's my whole point. Now, if it's just generally, oh, well, this black man got beat in the street and it's Black Lives Matter, they ain't signing on to that. Why is that? I mean, there are black people in your community. You get what I'm saying? there are women in your community. So you want everybody to sign on to your stuff, but where are you when our civil rights are trampled on? But you're there if it has something to do with the law and your rights. And that's just my take on this whole thing. And I'm sorry, I don't mean to ramble.
No, it's absolutely fine. Oh, thank you for that. Yeah, wow, that's a lot of information. I wanted to continue on and ask you about probably some of your experiences in college. How was that like for you? And where did you get your degree in?
Let's see. My undergraduate degree is in nonprofit management, and I have an MBA.
Oh, very cool. Very cool. And where do you currently work now?
I work for Housing Connections. Basically, I oversee the Housing Choice Voucher Program for Pulaski County.
Okay, cool. All right.
Housing equality.
Housing equality sounds good. Cool. And you do a lot of volunteer work, from what I've heard as well. So what exactly do you do? What's your, what do you exactly?
Well, I'll admit, since I moved back, I mean, when I was in Chicago, I did a lot of volunteer work. I did, you know, I worked on the civil, you know, I worked on immigrant issues. I was served on the board for a prominent agency that, and did school trainings as well for prominent agencies that look to bring equality to LGBTQ youth in schools, like K through 12. Did a lot of education with staff and students and the like. But since I've moved back here, I mean, I tried to get into that. And that's actually how I met Garland. He was part of, when I first moved back, you know, I was like, well, where's the gay community here? I mean, I haven't been here since I was a kid. So I don't know. And when I was a kid, I wasn't gay here or didn't know I was. You get me? And so I tried to get into that, and that's how I met Garland. There was this group called Roanoke Diversity, and because they were afraid to call it gay, but that's just another story. And that's how I met Garland. And I mean, I tried to get into that for a little while, but it just wasn't, you know, for me personally. Just, you know, it's not my speed, not my thing, not for me. So yeah, I mean, to be honest, I don't really do a lot of volunteer work anymore. My job and, you know, just the significance of, you know, the communities that I serve is pretty fulfilling to me. But yeah, I mean, if I found an agency that, I thought would be great to connect with here, I certainly would.
Oh, okay. So yeah, you met with Eric Garland.
It looks like it's really good.
What's that?
I was asking her what she's eating. I was like, whatever she's eating, it looks really good. Sorry.
So, no, it's okay. So you know Eric Garland. So how exactly did you guys meet?
Yeah, Garland was my buddy. He's like one of the first folks that I met when I moved back here from Chicago in 2009.
Yeah, he spoke to us in our one of our first classes because he's also doing an interview, I believe, or he at least is a community partner that's working with us. So seems like a very nice guy. But yeah, it's awesome that you guys are helping us work on our project for this year. So we really appreciate that. So I wanted to ask you a bit more about when you moved back to Virginia. Why did you? And do you was this, if you can remember when you moved, was this before or after what happened in Charlottesville in 2017?
It was before. So I moved back here in 2009, because for my mom. So basically, in the 90s, my mom was diagnosed with these seizures, and you know, over time they got worse. They became grand mal seizures. And when I was out in Chicago, I lived in Chicago for over 14 years. And when I was out in Chicago, because my family didn't want to worry me, they would never really tell me what was going on. And I would come home maybe typically once a year around Christmas. Sometimes I'd come twice around Thanksgiving as well. And my mother got significantly worse. Like, her grandma seizures were just out of control. I was worried. So I came home, and that was the initial reason why I came home. Then it was a different health problem that she eventually passed away of. So yeah, that's why I came home initially.
Oh, okay. So you said that you ended up moving before what happened in Charlottesville in 2017. It was
I moved back from Chicago. I moved back from Chicago back to here, Southwest Virginia, in 2009.
Okay, so you were here for quite a long time before.
Yeah.
That's interesting. So did you notice anything change between, because that was around the year that Obama got elected as well into the presidency.
Yeah, I was actually, when Obama got elected, I was still in Chicago. And keep in mind, he was a son of Chi-Town, so.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But yeah, it was around during that time, I guess. Have you seen anything, like a transition between that time that you've moved back to 2017 when that when the riots in Charlottesville occurred, in terms of race relations?
Do I see a change?
Yeah, did you know, like in the political sphere as well, like, did you know, during that span of time did you see a change?
What the change is that because of political correctness, or I don't know, whatever you want to call it, it used to be racism was more hidden. Recently, it's become like it was back in the day. People don't care. I'm a racist, right? So yeah, it's not that it went away. It was always racism from the beginning of time. The difference is when it's hidden and when it's visible. When white folks need to feel like they need to hide it, and when they feel comfortable to show it. I mean, so that, yeah, the difference is hidden to visible. I mean, feeling that you have the community support where you can now be the KKK again. I mean, that's the difference. Yeah. I mean, honestly.
Was that weird for you? Did you see any of that live on TV, or did you see any of that footage at that time, and how'd that make you feel if you did?
In Charlottesville?
Yeah, in Charlottesville, I mean.
Yeah, I mean, I saw much of that. I saw the little Nazis marching around talking about Jews and this and that. I mean, look. I mean, how does that make me feel? Quite frankly, I mean, in look, I don't give a good googly crap about what white people think, what straight people think, what anybody the fuck think. I mean, when you're secure with yourself, what other people do with it, it don't matter. You get what I'm saying? How did I feel about that? There was a bunch of ignorant white people marching around on my TV screen. Yeah. That's what I think about it. Okay? Now, where it affects me is when that ignorant crap becomes law or policy, then that affects me. Now, you want to march around like a little idiot, looking like a little KKK, ooh, hi, Hitler. Now, when it becomes any kind of law or policy that affects me or other people, well, that's when I care. But other than that, people can believe what they believe, think what they think. I don't give a shit. I'm not here to appease you. I'm not here to educate you. And that's important. Educate you. Because it appears that every minority group was put on earth to educate people about why they shouldn't be this or why they shouldn't be that. Why we got to educate folk? Did anyone sit you down and educate you on white privilege? No. You learned it, didn't you? Did anyone sit there and educate you on anything to do with a community that is not a minority group? No. We all learned that. We didn't have to just, you get me. But yet they sitting back thinking that our whole life is to educate them. Oh, well, this is what it's like to be this, and this is what it's like to be black, and this is my experience. When are you going to sit back and educate me on what it's like to be white? Right? I mean, that is not the expectation. So, yeah, I mean, that's just my view of things. Now, I'm not saying I don't educate people. I do it because, yeah, that's what it is, but I don't feel like I am called to do it. And I feel that minority groups, I don't care what minority group you fall into, it's kind of like this requirement that your whole life is to be educating people about why you should have your rights. And wait, well, okay, who you are. Okay, well, they're not educating me on who they are, right? You get me. I'm not expected that someone's going to sit down and say, okay, Katina, this is what it's like to be white. And this, no, you know, but yeah, I'm supposed to sit down and educate you on this is what it's like to be black. I mean, come on, man. So my whole thing is, yeah, like I said, I saw a bunch of idiots walking around the screen, look like a bunch of dumbasses, and well, whatever, that's their right. But the point where it becomes any kind of policy or law, or they're fucking with me, trying to come after me, okay, that's my business. But other than that, whatever. I don't let things like that, you know?
Sounds interesting.
I mean, because in the end, folks change, in my opinion, based on personal experience. They know a black person. They know a trans person. They know a gay person. They know, and they're friends with that person. They have a mutual respect and, you know, a bond with that person. That's how people change, okay? Now, there's the other route. You can make them change. You can change the law. You can enforce policy, yes. But usually, that's the hard way. I mean, people will follow a law, follow a policy, but that does not change people's heart and minds. It changes their behavior and their action. How you change hearts and minds is when people get to know black people. When, oh, my best friend, we grew up together and I love her and you don't talk bad about her. Oh, my cousin's gay and I love him. That's how you change heart and minds. Now, like I said, we're always changing behavior and action, which is great. That's an important part of it. But in the end, real change is hearts and minds. Hearts and minds. And that's a personal connection.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for that. I know you were saying how, and I can agree with you on a lot of what you just said in terms of, like, we can't allow these, like, people who have these prejudices to, like, allow us to feel like their messages matter and, like, we need to care about them and, or validate them through our, you know, our attention to them. But then recently we had something happened at the White House on January 6th with the Capitol riots, another instance where we have a bunch of white people going and exercising their right to, you know, to essentially take over our government or whatever they were trying to attempt to do there. But, you know, those are things that we need to think about in terms of, like, what does that say about America's acceptance to diverse perspectives and people? And does, like, and well, as it is exactly getting what, worse. And...
I think it says exactly what I just said. Yeah. You have a bunch of boneheads who are racist as hell.
It doesn't concern you, though, about in terms of, like, making it.
And the thing is,
or normalizing this behavior towards minor. Or, like, maybe I should say it differently. Like normalizing being discriminatory in the vein of having free speech, or you know what I'm saying? Like, normalizing this behavior,
Yes.
Is that concerning you?
I agree with you. If my whole point is, my whole point is when you have members of Congress who's standing up there and an ex-president standing up there condoning that behavior, right? Yeah. I mean, that's when you speak up. You don't, you get me. I mean, but
are you hopeful, though, nonetheless?
Am I hopeful that America will ever be anything but a racist place to be? yes. And I say this because, first of all, we can look at just the science of it all, that, you know, what year is it going to be where the white folks are going to be in the minority and most people are going to be mixed anyway, because I'm, you know, but I say that because, like I said to you, now think about history and where Black people, Latinos, Asians, and I ain't saying that's not happening today, especially when you go to bigger cities, don't mix. I have my community. I never go outside of my community. Even when I lived in Chicago, let me tell you something. I met Black folk on the South Side, Latinos on the West Side that never traveled outside of their neighborhood in Chicago. I'm like, what are you talking about? What? How you never travel outside your neighborhood? So I'm not saying that doesn't exist. But my whole point is, once people, look, this is about hearts and minds. Hearts and minds. Once folks meet other people, all right, they love somebody. Oh, well, that's my best friend. We grew up, we thick and thin. You know, it's hard to close out, off your heart and your mind than it is to this serene, you know what I mean? This, you get what I'm saying? Like, once you have a personal connection with someone, and quite frankly, when you think about race relations, yes, of course, there's the whole legal aspect of it, the whole policy aspect of it. That's not what changed white folk. Oh, well, the law says this, and now I like you. No, what happened was they began to meet folks who weren't like themselves, and they realized, oh, you're not that much different than me, and you're my best friend, and that's how that shit changes. So even with this crap that happened at the Capitol, it's the same thing. Unfortunately, change is slow. Oh my God, it's so slow. It is the slowest daggone thing. We all be dead and buried before then. I mean, change is a very slow process. So do I believe that in the end, there will be some sense of a kumbaya, likely, just because demographics are changing, in terms of race, intermarriages, not even marriages, you know, mixed babies, people of color. And you look at that Latino community, they come over here like droves, and they're going to be owning this place soon. So, yeah, I mean, it's going to, whether they like it or not, it's coming, because people of color, even when you look at the LGBT community, no doubt. Did you know that when you look at LGBT couples who are Black and Latino, that they raise children at higher rates than their white counterparts? They haven't raised children at higher rates than their white counterparts. Change is coming. Yeah, eventually.
No, that's all that you said, like, a bunch of interesting points to me that I've been trying to see if I can circle back for the last, like, few minutes that we have. I wanted to kind of go back and talk about some more about white privilege in general. And also, we all want to touch on white gay privilege as well, because I thought you made some interesting points with that, too. So, yeah, like, with all that's going on, you know, politically and, you know, race, you know, race relation-wise in the United States, I feel like, just in general, do you feel like white men, period, feel like they are out of place in a world that is becoming more and more diverse, but in the vein in which it's kind of like against white people in general? It's like, you know what I'm saying? It's like, it's becoming to a point where it's like, white men probably feel threatened by the growing amount of diversity in the United States, and they're feeling, do you feel like they might feel a bit left out, or probably at this point feeling a bit useless, and then now they're trying to find some sort of meaning and purpose in their lives, generally speaking? Do you get what I mean when I say that they're giving?
I see, like, exactly what you're saying. And yeah, I mean, my answer is that the proof is in the pudding. When change is on the rise, that's when you see people act out, right? Mm-hmm. They weren't acting out before, right? Because they felt comfortable. The fact that they're storming the Capitol, you looking at this Charlottesville thing, is because they feel threatened. Otherwise, why would they even march? If there's no threat, what's the march for? All right, we march because it's a threat. They ain't marching. They're just like, oh, look at them people marching. Well, now they marching. So that tells you that they feel threatened. That because people act out, they fight when there's a threat. So yes, I mean, I mean, I think that it's obvious based on what you see.
Yeah, no, and that's exactly right. I wanted to also talk a little bit about white gay privilege as well, because I think that's interesting. We also talked about this in class, where even within the LGBTQ community, it's interesting because it's in, like, what we talked about was like how white gay men feel a bit excluded from the rest of the LGBTQ community because they are kind of like the ones who already have the most privilege. At times, it seems absurd. I frankly would disagree and say, black lesbian women tend to be the most discriminated against.
They own the LGBT. Okay. Look, girl, I don't know where you got that information from, but let me tell you something.
Just like,
that is not true, and ain't no white man feeling that way, and let me tell you why. Because the white men in the LGBT is nothing but a reflection of all of society, where white men control the world. White men control the world. These gay men are not what you just said. They control the world too. And you know what? They control the LGBTQ community. Who's out front in the LGBT? Yeah, they may put a person of color out front, but who's behind it? Who's behind the money? Who's behind going to the courts? Who's behind going to the legislator, who determines the LGBTQ agenda of what they're going to fight for? White men. Now, you go back and prove to me that that's not true. Because if you look at behind all these prominent LGBT agencies, you're going to find white folk. And they set the agenda for what the LGBT community, you know, is going to focus on. It's their agenda. That's just a fact.
Yeah, you brought up gay marriage and how, like, and that's true. Like, we I don't want to say, like, you know, gay marriage isn't an important issue that people wanted to get.
No, it's not about whether it's important or not. We're talking about an issue of privilege versus issues of life and death.
Sure.
You can't go to school without getting your ass kicked, when you can't go to work for fear of being fired, do you think you care about who you're going to marry? That is when you don't have to worry about going to work and getting fired. When you don't have to worry about going to school and getting your ass kicked, then you can focus on an issue of privilege, which is marriage is not a right, it's a damn privilege. And let's just be honest, it's an institution of privilege. Yeah. Marriage is an institution of privilege. I'm not saying that LGBT people shouldn't have that right. They should. But what happened was the white community emphasized that over issues of life and death that folks of color and trans of all colors were facing at the time. And that's just my whole point. They're dealing with life and death, white men dealing with marriage. And that just tells you we can look at that just in the larger society. I mean, forget sexual orientation. I mean, what white people are fighting for and what black folk are fighting for, right? I mean, I'm not really seeing this huge movement of white folks talking about police brutality. That's black folk and Latino folk, right? And with this whole COVID-19 thing, I'm not seeing a huge population of white folk talk about they're being discriminated against and called the Chinese flu and beaten. That's Asian folk. And that's my point.
Yeah.
We all deal with different realities based on the color of our skin, minus sexual orientation. Sexual orientation and then your gender adds to it. You know what I'm saying? It adds to it. Now think about the Black Civil Rights Movement, the actual real Black Civil Rights Movement. Guess who they didn't want represented in there? Gay people. Think about the Women's Rights Movement. Guess who Women's Rights, the whole suffrage movement, guess who they didn't want represented in their movement? Black women. That's my whole point.
Yeah.
You get me? Because Black leaders during the Black Civil Rights Movement thought, well, that whole gay thing, that's going to hurt our cause. White women during the Women's Suffrage Movement thought, oh, that whole black woman thing, that's going to hurt our cause. LGBT people currently and their movement, well, if we attach ourselves to that black stuff or that women's rights stuff, that's going to hurt our cause. And that's my whole point. You know, I mean, each group alienates a certain portion of their community, hoping that it's going to fare better on their path to whatever it is they're fighting for. And that's just history. And that's the truth.
That's sad. But no, but that's actually, no, it's very true. I mean, yeah, well, you've said a lot here today that I wish I could kind of go back to and talk to with you about more. But I wanted to, we only have about 5 minutes left, so we should probably close. But I did want to ask you, so just like, given your experiences between, you know, living in Virginia and going to school in Chicago and having like your young adulthood there, you know, in general, as being a black lesbian woman, like what was the differences between living in those two places? And like, was there anything from those experiences that you can draw from now that, you know, that you could say that represent you very well to this day or anything like that?
Well, I mean, obviously, the difference is in a big city, you're going to have a large gay community. You're going to have in Chicago, there's a whole neighborhood dedicated just gay folks. Actually, two of them. Andersonville is typically considered the lesbian aspect. And then Boys Town, well, I guess that describes itself. So, I mean, you've got a huge millions upon millions upon millions upon millions of out gay people who just doing their thing and they ain't thinking about, okay, I'm gay, whatever. I'm just shopping. I'm just, right? So in a community like this, obviously you're going to have a much smaller community and you're not going to have gay owned businesses out, you know, specific multiple bars or social scenes where gay folks hang out and connect and meet up with each other. So yeah, I mean, obviously that's going to be a significant difference. Also, you can't make a living I've never seen no gay agency here where you can make a good living working in the gay community. I mean, let me tell you something. I made good freaking money working in the LGBT community in Chicago. I made my whole living on that. Well, ain't like you're going to find a job like that here in Southwest Virginia. So, yeah, I mean, there are significant differences. I mean, come on now. And let's not forget that we are in the state of Virginia. I mean, come on. I mean, the state that said we're not going to segregate schools until the late 70s when everybody else, you know, in the world did. So, yeah. I mean, come on now. You're dealing with a whole different scenario in the Commonwealth than you are in other places.
That's true. So while, I guess while you're in Chicago, you didn't say you dated too much when you were in high school. So did you start dating while you were there and start to get like more
familiar? Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, obviously, yeah, because, yeah, I mean, even if I wasn't gay in high school, I mean, let me tell you something. My mama, because my real father died when we were little. And of course, I was raised by a stepfather. And my mom always worked full time. I never did any kind of, you know, dependence on any kind of government or food stamps or housing. Always provided for the family. And so she put us in everything so she can go to work. Man, I was in band. I was in theater. I was in track and field. I was on the forensics team. I was in everything. I was in dance. I was in everything. I mean, I didn't even think about sexual orientation and dating because I was busy, you know, doing my thing, you know, man.
That's fair.
So,
well, that's great. I mean, we're really happy that you've been able to take this time to speak to us, but we do have about a minute left, but if there's anything else that you'd want to say that we haven't touched on, or like if there's anything that you've been meaning to like address to us about in terms of your perspective as being someone as a part of the LGBT community?
No, not really. I mean, I think I've pretty much told you how I feel. I typically don't leave nothing left unsaid. So, I mean, yeah.
Awesome. Well, we really appreciate your time. I hope you have a great rest of your day. And I I guess we'll get back to you in terms of the rest of this interview. So thank you so much for your time.
All right. Good luck to you guys. I'm sorry for the last minute. I hope you guys can knock it out.
That's so good. Thank you so much.
All right, guys. Have a good one.
Yeah, you too. Bye-bye.